There was a mighty nation, blessed above all of creation. It was a rare and precious pearl, conceived in faith and liberty, home of the brave, land of the free. It was the envy of the world. But this shining city on a hill has turned from the Creator's will and let evil take control. Now the reckless men who lead them want to strip away their freedom and to steal their very soul. Now it's smoke and mirrors, switching baits, criticize and confiscate, and let the guilty walk away. In this once righteous, godly nation, in the halls of education, they forbid a child to pray. They say we need to spread the wealth. They pretend to guard the health of the feeble and the poor. While the hand they hold behind their backs confuses and conceals the fact that the wolf is at the door. There's an unseen hand that pulls strings. It makes his little puppets dance to every song he sings. As the night falls in on a rising tide, look beyond the shadows, behold a pale horse ride. They claim to seek a new world order, nations without borders, but don't believe the lie. Even in this wealthy nation, it could come down to starvation in the twinkling of an eye. They tell us there will soon be peace, our lives will be an endless feast, but they lead us toward the dark. Distant sabers rattle, and the armies train for battle as the beast prepares his mark. There's an unseen hand that pulls a string and makes his little puppets dance to any song he sings. As the night rolls in on the rising tide, look beyond the shadows, behold a pale horse ride. It's time for every righteous man to step up tall, take a stand. There is so little time. For if we fear and hesitate, soon it will be too late. We're the last hope of mankind. Time hurries on, the shadows fall, the hand is writing on the wall. But even now, there's still a chance. For if the ones called by God's name repent of sin and seek his face, he will hear and heal the land. There's an unseen hand reaching from above, and a gentle voice that beckons to the shelter of his love. Come on home, my wayward child, cause out on the horizon there's a pale horse running wild. A fairy cub, can't you hear the thundering hoofbeats of a pale horse running
radio show on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Use this. Mullins, World Order.
You don't need that one.
Oh, okay.
And here's your water.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here today. I was very excited when I came up here for the first time and saw what Wes has and his helpers have accomplished here, that this is indeed a very exciting time for all of us, as Kathy said yesterday, because the opportunities are actually opening up. What we are achieving as citizens is being accomplished in spite of the greatest criminal network in the world. So what these criminals are actually doing is inspiring us to achieve even greater things. And the new economy, which they talk about, is simply the achievements of the citizens to thwart the criminals in their ongoing conspiracy. And as I pointed out, the criminals realize that if you want to steal, steal from everybody. Don't just take a gun and go and hold up one person. You want to hold up everybody in the world. And of course, what I'm talking about here today is my life as a detective, which was the last thing in the world I ever expected to be. I expected to be a romance novelist and to lead a bohemian life, have a house in the south of France, and do the Ernest Hemingway routine, you know. Have a few movie scripts and so forth, but it just hasn't worked out that way because I met an indicted person named Ezra Pound, who had been indicted for treason because he tried to persuade the people of the United States not to enter World War II. Now, if there's one thing that the criminals hate, they hate a person who interferes with their war plans because war is the most profitable thing they can get into. They create enormous debts, which they can live on for many years from the interest. And so when you become a pacifist, which is essentially what Ezra Pound was, then you incur their lifelong enmity. Now, Ezra Pound was indicted for treason. There was a story in a paper in Virginia just a couple of weeks ago about me, and on the front page they said Ezra Pound had been imprisoned for treason, which was of course a total lie, as was most of the other story too, and I'll be suing them when I get back. I didn't have time to get the lawsuit ready, and of course there's no hurry about it anyway, because there's no statute of limitations on conspiracy. So you can take your time, and it's always better to proceed cautiously and prepare your material. And when you go into court, it's really already a fait accompli. You've got everything there that you need. And my principle, which I'll go into tomorrow about law, is that I discovered that our legal system is so complex that no lawsuit can ever really be ended. You can just keep it going forever. And of course, most people can't because they don't have the funds, because the lawyers have set it up so they'll bleed you dry within about 18 months. So no matter what you want to do or how good your case is, you can no longer proceed because the lawyer's already taken all your money. So Ezra Pound was never tried, was never in prison for treason, but probably his greatest crime in the eyes of the criminals was that he set me loose on the Federal Reserve System, which happened in 1948. And when I met him at the Federal Hospital for the Insane, it's called, St. Elizabeth's, which is a place where they put political prisoners. And fortunately for him, his wife came over from England, and so they could not proceed with the treatments which they usually give people there. And he was imprisoned in what they call the hellhole, which is the MR, the male receiving ward, and this is the most violent people who are brought into St. Elizabeth's. And they put Ezra down in this human hellhole, and he was there for about 6 months. And his friend T.S. Eliot, who had come over to be awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature, saw the conditions he was in, and he absolutely went through the roof, and he had to move him to a quieter ward, Chestnut Ward. And that's where I met him, in the Chestnut Ward with the other Chestnuts. And so one of the first things that Ezra said to me, he said, I would like for you to look into the Federal Reserve System. Well, I had never heard of the Federal Reserve System. I was 25 years old, never had a bank account, and was living on a very modest stipend from the government to go to college. So he said, well, look in your wallet. So I looked in the wallet, and there on the bill it said Federal Reserve, which I had never noticed, and which I'm sure nobody else in the United States ever noticed. It was a Federal Reserve note. And interestingly enough, it was not money at all. It was a green dollar bill. But it was such fake money, such counterfeit money with nothing behind it, that Congress finally had to pass a special law, the Legal Tender Act, making this counterfeit money legal tender, which meant that before the Congressional Lawful Tender Act, it was not lawful money. So we had been using unlawful money for years. Now, by act of Congress, it was suddenly lawful. But it was still the same fake money that it was before, because it was not money. It's a promissory note. The Federal Reserve note is issued against government bonds. In other words, it's a paper bill issued against paper backing. Now, there's no gold, there's no diamonds, there's no nothing behind it, except the people's promise to pay. Because the Federal Reserve Act was written in 1913, stating that they were giving this privately owned bank, the Federal Reserve Bank, license to print money, which is what a central bank does. A central bank has a license to print money, and all the money that it prints becomes the liability of the government. And, of course, there is no government. There's only taxpayers. So all the money that these bankers print and issue and circulate is charged against the taxpayers. And they have to pay interest on it. It's called interest-bearing currency. One of the first things that Ezra Pound told me, he says, you have to learn the difference between interest-bearing currency and non-interest-bearing currency. Well, he might as well have been talking Greek to me. I never heard such confusing terms in my knowledge. Because I thought, how can currency be interest-bearing? But it is. All the currency is interest-bearing. And we have two dead presidents who could testify to that, because in 1863, President Lincoln, in order to finance the war, which the bankers did not want him to finance the war, they wanted the United States to split into two small countries, the North and the South. So they wouldn't lend him any money to fight the war. And he called in the bankers. He said, look, I've got to finance the war. I want to borrow some money. They said, well, yes, you can have money at the 19% interest. Well, the average interest rate at that time was 1%. So Lincoln knew that the bankers were having him on. So he looked around, and someone told him, well, the Treasury lawfully can issue money, which is non-interest-bearing, called greenbacks. And so Lincoln said, well, I'll do that. So he issued the greenback currency, non-interest-bearing currency, and financed the Civil War with that. Well, of course, the bankers were very annoyed by this, because they lost a lot of money on the interest that they would have gotten on interest-bearing currency. So when you cross the bankers, they have only one answer, and that's assassination. So they assassinated Lincoln. Well, 100 years later, we get another young, bright president, John F. Kennedy, who had gone to Harvard, but apparently did not take any history courses, because someone told him, Kennedy, like most presidents, wanted to be remembered. And he asked some of his advisors, what could I do to really get the people behind me and have them appreciate me for what I've done? And so one of them said, why don't you go after the Federal Reserve System? They said, if you will get the Federal Reserve System off the backs of the American people, they'll put statues of you in every town in the United States. So Kennedy thought, well, that's a very attractive proposition. I think I'll do that. So he goes over to the Treasury and says, print me up some non-interest-bearing currency, the greenback currency. Well, they did this. And, of course, then the bankers, again, were horrified. They said, well, what is this guy doing? He's going to ruin us. So they hurriedly he had this vice president named Lyndon Baines Johnson, and Kennedy had already decided to dump Johnson, which meant that his political future was nil. And so Johnson said to Kennedy, well, look, we're having a little trouble with the party down in Texas. Why don't you go down to Dallas and see what you can do? So when Kennedy went to Dallas, they had not one, they had five different assassination teams waiting for him. In case one didn't make it, the other would back up, you know. So Kennedy didn't make it, and that was the end of the greenback currency on Kennedy. So he went the same way as Lincoln, simply because he issued non-interest-bearing currency, which I admit is confusing and sounds dull and routine, but unfortunately, this is the way that the world operates. These bankers are always conspirators, they're criminals, and they'll do anything to keep their system going. So, and that is why we had an anarchist in France in the 19th century named Proudhon. And Proudhon was a philosopher of some repute. And after many years of studying, he issued his dictum. He said, all government is a crime. He didn't say some government, or some parts of the government may be a little criminal. He said, all government is a crime, which is true. And why is all government a crime? It's because part of government is law enforcement. And when people get into government and they realize they control the law enforcement, then this becomes a license to commit whatever crimes they want, a license to steal, a license to lead the country into wars, anything they want to do. And this is a very heady situation. They suddenly realize, here I am, I've reached power, I can do anything I want, no one can control me. And so this is why all government becomes a crime. And of course the people have really only one solution, and that is revolution. That's what Thomas Jefferson said. To have a successful government, you have to have a revolution every 25 years. Well, he said that 200 years ago, so we're a little overdue. But let's hope for the best. And because the United States was founded on revolution, and it's a revolutionary state, so revolution is really great. I have nothing against it. And look forward to it, as a matter of fact. And instead of my life as an artist and a bohemian, my life has been lived as a revolutionary, which was not what I intended at all. And in fact, I'm a person who avoids confrontation, and I like to take it the easy way. I don't go looking for fights and so forth. And the result was that J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI, who had his eye on me for some time, he announced that I was the most dangerous man in America. Well, from his point of view, I was. But I wasn't a threat to my fellow Americans. They had nothing to fear from me. But J. Edgar Hoover and the criminals did. And so that's why they designated me with that title. And, of course, I was under daily surveillance by the FBI for 33 years. And I would actually come out of my apartment in Chicago. There'd be a row of cars with FBI agents. And as I stepped out, they would ostentatiously take their telephones from the dash and talk and make sure that I could see that all this is going on, and that I would collapse in total fear at this terrible fate that was waiting for me. So I just walked by and I thought, well, look, gee, all this attention is nice, you know. Don't know what I've done to deserve it, but and they spent millions of dollars to keep me under surveillance. And of course, during that entire time, I never even got a parking ticket, because when you're under daily surveillance by the FBI, it limits your activities. You can't go around robbing banks or So I had to be a good citizen whether I wanted to be or not. Because they had all of the instruments of modern communications. They had videos, and they had bugs on my telephone and so forth. And so I just had to behave myself, which I managed to do, but I certainly did not like it. But actually, I started out, as I say, as the protege of a man who was indicted but never tried for treason. Ezra Pound was indicted for treason by a associate of President Roosevelt's at the White House named Alger Hiss. He had Ezra Pound indicted for treason, and then, of course, he became one of the most famous traitors in the United States himself. But Alger Hiss had Ezra Pound indicted for treason because Alger Hiss was a KGB agent, and, of course, as a loyal communist, he could... So I had to be a good citizen whether I wanted to be or not. Communications, they had videos, and they had bugs on my telephone and so forth. And so I just had to behave myself, which I managed to do, but I certainly did not like it. But actually, I started out, as I say, as the protege of a man who was indicted, but never tried for treason. Ezra Pound was indicted for treason by an associate of President Roosevelt's at the White House named Alger Hiss. He had Ezra Pound indicted for treason, and then, of course, he became one of the most famous traitors in the United States himself. But Alger Hiss had Ezra Pound indicted for treason because Alger Hiss was a KGB agent, and, of course, as a loyal communist, he considered Ezra Pound a fascist, an anti-communist, and a real threat. So they both wound up in prison, but Ezra used to complain. They kept him for 13 and a half years, and Alger Hiss only served 6 years. And when Alger Hiss got out, he got a government pension. Ezra Pound got no pension at all because he had, of course, never been in the government itself. But when I met Ezra Pound, I was taken there by one of my professors at the art school in Washington I was attending at that time. And I could not understand why Ezra Pound would want to talk to me, you know. I didn't know anything. So I got over there and I found out that being a prisoner, he needed people coming in to talk to him. And he did have, over the period of 13 years he was there, he had 3,800 people come from all over the world to sit at his feet and to learn from him. So he was always a teacher. And he started right in. When I walked in, it was winter time there in Chestnut Ward. It was very dark and gloomy in the afternoon. And I was let in by a keeper who had an enormous collection of keys, bigger than my leg, hanging from his waist. And he unlocked his door, and I walked in, and then he closed the door and locked it behind me. And you always have a little feeling, well, do you wonder if he'll ever unlock it for you? Maybe this is their chance, you know, to have me in there. So I walked in, I saw Ezra Pound sitting there, a very distinguished-looking person, and suddenly it struck me, this man hasn't committed any crime. What is he doing sitting here? Why is he a prisoner? And I got so angry that my whole head turned black, and I was so enraged that I just thought then, I'm going to try to get him out of here. And I've never been so angry in my life, and that anger has lasted well over 50 years because nothing has been corrected. I did finally get Ezra Pound out of St. Elizabeth, and the government dropped all charges against him. Well, in fact, early in our association, I said to Ezra, well, what are your prospects here? And he said, well, I expect the government to drop all charges and to release me. And so when he told me that, I thought, well, he really must be crazy because there's no way this government's going to drop these charges. And so he asked me to ask around because I knew a lot of influential people in Washington through George Stimson at the Press Club. And so he said, ask around and see what you think you can find out. So I asked George Stimson, I said, would you ask people around, what does the government plan to do with Ezra Pound? Are they just going to keep him for a few years and drop the thing, or what are they going to do? So George asked a couple of people in Washington who were proteges of his. One of them was General Lucius Clay, the hero of the Berlin airlift. Another one was a Supreme Court Justice, Tom Clark. Tom Clark, by the way, got on the Supreme Court of the United States with a brilliant background. He was a lawyer for the mafia. And So they figured, well, why don't we just put a guy on the Supreme Court? So they put Tom Clark on the Supreme Court. His son, Ramsey Clark, by the way, is a very famous dissenting lawyer at the present time. But he asked Tom Clark and he asked General Clay and someone else, what is Ezra Pound's chances? So a few days later, I saw George and I said, what did they say? And George says, well, they all say that the whole power of the government is dedicated to keeping Ezra Pound there for the rest of his life. He'll never be released. And of course, this was very depressing news. It was not news that I could take back to St. Elizabeth, so I never told Ezra any of this. But in my own mind, I was convinced that George had said was right. They intended never to release him. Because they treated Jefferson Davis the same way after the Civil War. They threw him into prison, in a dungeon, very brutally treated, and he stayed there for years. No trial, they finally released him. But so I continued to visit Ezra and got started on the Federal Reserve investigation, and I found that it was indeed a criminal conspiracy. Plus, it was not a public bank, as people thought, with the name Federal Reserve. Federal Reserve is like Federal Express, you know. It's a private company. And there are no reserves because they create money out of nothing. And, you know, in the Bible it said, and God created the earth. But it does not say anything about God created money. So people came onto the earth and had no money. Apparently God overlooked something there. And I don't think he ever dreamed that we'd need money because... In a just society, you would not need money. People would do things for each other. And that would be it. You wouldn't need gold and silver, any of that stuff. But people didn't do things the way God thought he wanted them to, or planned for them to. And so they began to need money in order to transact business with each other. And of course, this created the opportunity for criminals because, as Amschel Rothschild said, give me the right to issue a nation's money, and I can control, I don't care what laws they make. And that's the situation we have today, because the private bankers issue the money, print all the money they want, and then they bribe the lawmakers. Doesn't matter if it takes $1 million or $5 million, they're printing the money anyway. So they go to the lawmakers and said, here's $1 million, and I want you to pass our bill. And of course, the lawmaker doesn't have any working citizens coming up and saying, here's $1 million, we want you to pass bills for us. And so the banker is the only one who brings in any money, so he's the one who gets the laws passed. And that's a system that you have, which is called democracy. It's called democracy because it's the rule of the mob. But it's not, it's the rule of the bankers, but the mob is controlled by money. So it's actually the rule of the mob. And that's why you have legislatures which pass laws to rob the people, to rob the 6 billion people of the world. Now, how do the bankers rob the 6 billion people of the world? Because that sounds pretty difficult. It's not difficult at all once you get your system going. It's a consortium of central banks throughout the world, each of which has the license to print money. Now, Ezra told me very early in our relationship, he said, sovereignty, a nation's control of its own destiny, lies in the right to issue money and the right to control foreign policy. Well, of course, you citizens have no right to issue money, and you have no voice in foreign policy. I don't think anybody in this room has any voice in foreign policy. That's all decided for you by the people, the elites, who consider themselves your betters. They consider themselves better than you because they don't have more money than you. They have all the money because they can print all that they want. And of course they have, in case you get the inspiration, well, I'll print some money too, then they throw you into prison. You're a counterfeiter. So you either use their counterfeit money or you go to prison if you try to use your own. It's that simple, and that's the way it works. Now, they also have another means of control, which is which encompasses everybody. Nobody can escape it, and that's called the tax, the income tax. Now, if these people had the license to print money, Why would they need your income tax? Because they can print all the money they want. They don't care if you have $1,000 or $200,000. They don't need your money. But the income tax was instituted solely for control. Not only to control you, but to control the volume and flow of money. Because all central banks, with their right to issue money, are inflationary. Because they can print all they want. There's absolutely nothing in the laws which says they can only print $1 million a day or anything like that. It's unlimited. And all that money becomes your obligation, interest-bearing currency obligation. You're paying interest on all this money that the bankers are having such fun printing and bribing your legislators with. So the Federal Reserve, as a privately owned bank, had to control this inflationary money, and all central banks have to do this because the printing presses are running and the money is flowing out, and they have to have some control. Well, the control is the income tax, because you let people have the money and wages. They have to work for it. Nobody gives them anything, but they have to work for it. So, and then as they earn the money, the government takes it back as income tax. So they give what they call the subsistence wage. Now, the subsistence wage was developed in England by the Rothschilds about 1810. And they developed a system. They said, well, we want people to work, and we want them to work hard, but we cannot allow them to accumulate any assets. So therefore, we will give them a subsistence wage, and if they begin to save money, we'll tax it and take it away from them. And so this is what the subsistence wage is. And in all the so-called democracies, the subsistence wage is the fate of the workers. The worker bees have to live on a subsistence wage. They cannot get rich, and they cannot have the finer things of life because the government takes it back. In fact, I defined the difference between capitalism and communism many years ago. I said, under communism, profit is considered evil. You are not supposed to exploit your fellow citizens by making a profit. So the government says you cannot make a profit. Well, there you take away the motivation for all economic activity. If you can't make a profit, why do it?
Sin.
So this gives the government, the communist government, the opportunity to control all economic activity, because they won't have any competition for the people. Because who's going to get out there and make things and work if they can't make a profit? Now, the capitalist country is entirely different. Under capitalism, the government says, go out and work hard and make all the profit you can. We don't care how much profit you make. And after you make the profit, the government takes the profit away from you and gives it to the communist countries. So that's the difference between capitalism and communism. Now, all during the Cold War, when we were spending $250 billion a year on defense to protect us from the Soviet menace, the menace of world communism, the Soviet state was living entirely on largesse from the United States taxpayers, and a lot from Canada, too. Canada was selling the Soviets wheat. Because the Soviets and the Bolshevik Revolution, the Ukraine was the breadbasket of Europe. They had the most wonderful wheat, and they fed all of Europe from this Ukrainian breadbasket. Well, the communist leaders, being mostly intellectuals who had never been on a farm, they had no idea where food came from, they decided to kill the peasants. In fact, the joke in Russia after the Bolshevik Revolution was, this is the workers' and peasants' party. They enslave the workers and kill the peasants. That's why it's the Peasants and Workers' Party. So that's the story of communism. And so from 1917 on, the United States taxpayers were the total support of the Communist Party in the Soviet Union. In fact, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, which was the central bank of the entire Federal Reserve system, most of its effort during the 1920s was dedicated to shoring up the collapsing communist system. See, the communist system collapsed almost immediately after the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917. Because the workers and peasants said, look, we own everything, we don't have to take care of anything because it's ours. And there was a story about a peasant who burned down a huge forest. And so they said to this peasant, why did you burn down the forest? He said, because it's ours now. We can do whatever we want. So they burned it down. And of course, they stopped growing wheat. So Herbert Hoover, who later became known as an anti-communist because he saved communism, you have a lot of these paradoxes in this kind of work. I have to tell you, you have to have a very flexible reasoning capacity, because Herbert Hoover became world famous as an anti-communist because he saved communism. And if you could figure that out, tell me, I'd like to know. And in fact, he set up the Hoover Institute at Stanford, California, called the Hoover Institute of War, Peace, and Revolution. And today it's very active. In fact, the whole Reagan administration in 1980 was pulled out of the Hoover Institute at Stanford University. And these were called the neoconservatives. And Reagan had a neoconservative administration. And they were all out of Hoover Institute, and they were all old-line socialists. So the great Reagan Revolution, anti-communist revolution, Reagan is standing up there saying the Soviet Union is the evil empire, and his whole administration was socialists behind him. He didn't know that, of course. Reagan would have known a socialist if one came up and bit him on the leg, but he was a Hollywood actor and a very good one. And, of course, his presidency was the culmination of his entire acting career. He was the best speaker, the most charismatic president we've ever had and ever will have, as a matter of fact. And so he simply played his role to perfection, and he was very good at it. And meanwhile, these neoconservative socialists ran the whole country.
Sorry, I have to cover your mic with your pad, please.
Oh, don't cover it.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Yeah, all right. So the Reagan Revolution was really a neoconservative revolution in which the socialists ran the country to suit themselves, and they ran up an enormous deficit, which created more interest for the bankers. And of course, this all went back to Thanksgiving week of 1910, as I discovered at the Library of Congress. I went to the Library of Congress and started digging out some things back in 1948, and I found that there had been a secret meeting of the bankers at Jekyll Island in 1910, and these were the most important bankers in New York. They got on a train in Hoboken to go down to Brunswick, Georgia. And Brunswick is a very interesting name because Brunswick was the origin of the Hanover family, the Dukes of Hanover, who became the kings of England in 1700. And they became the kings of England by some faked genealogy, which they had an obliging scholar draw up for them. And they went to England to become the kings of England. They didn't even speak English. The first three Georges of Hanover dynasty in England didn't speak English and didn't see why they should bother to learn it, because German was their language. And so here you had the leaders of Britain speaking only German. And finally, I think they did learn some English. And of course, today, Queen Elizabeth does speak English, but it took a while. Because these people have so much power, they do whatever they want. They say, I'm not going to bother to speak English in London. Let the English people speak, learn German, you know. They want to talk to me. So that was the Hanover dynasty, which happened to be the Illuminati and Freemasonry originated in Hanover province. And Brunswick, Georgia was named after the Brunswick Hanover family. And so this is where these bankers, their train went to Brunswick, Georgia. Then they went across the inlet to the Jekyll Island, which they had bought a few years earlier and made a private enclave. And the residents of Jekyll Island at that time comprised 1/6 of the wealth of the entire world. So these people were not Johnny-come-latelys. They knew what they were doing. And so they had their private meeting, and they got rid of all the servants on Jekyll Island and for their private meeting. And they brought in new servants, and they agreed they would only call each other by their first names. Paul Warburg was Paul, and Nelson Aldrich was Nelson. And ever after, they were known as the First Name Club because they only used first names. And all these people agreed they would never mention the fact that they'd ever been on Jekyll Island. Because what they did there was to secretly write the Federal Reserve Act with our central bank plan. Now, they had been trying to get a central bank in the United States since 1787. And the first bank of the United States, which was a central bank, was enacted over the opposition of Thomas Jefferson. And in my book, I quote Thomas Jefferson's opposition to it. He was just a farmer in Virginia, but he had an understanding of international banking, which is absolutely incredible. So he put down all the list of why you should oppose the central bank. But Alexander Hamilton persuaded George Washington to approve the plans for the First Bank of the United States. So Washington approved it. But then when Jefferson became president and the First Bank of the United States charter came up for renewal, Jefferson, of course, this was his moment. He refused to renew it. Well, the Bank of England, which actually controlled the central bank, was very annoyed. So they declared war on the United States. Now, when you go to school, you're probably taught that the War of 1812 was caused by the fact that British frigates stopped American ships on the high seas and took off their crews and put them on to work on their own ships. It's called impressing. Well, that did happen, but that wasn't the reason for the war whatsoever. The war was simply a punitive act against the United States to try to defeat them and bring them back in as a British colony because of they've refused to renew the charter of the First Bank of the United States. Well, and of course you had this war in which, of course, Canada was on the side of the British during the War of 1812, and they actually burned Washington, but we survived. And so then they set up a second central bank called the Second Bank of the United States. And along comes the hero of the War of 1812, General Andrew Jackson. And as president, he said, "By God, you are a gang of vipers, and I will root you out." He had righteous anger against these bankers. So he pulled the government deposits out of the Second Bank of the United States. Well, of course, it immediately collapsed in 1836. That was the end of the second central bank that we had in this country. So, in revenge, the Bank of England issued an order that no paper would be honored from the United States. All American securities, stocks, bonds were worthless as of that date. So we had our first financial collapse in the United States, the Panic of 1837. And it was caused simply as a punitive action, because when you make the bankers mad, they don't sit around and brood. They do something about it, like they murder Lincoln, they murder Kennedy, and so forth. And so they put the entire United States into financial collapse. Well, then the agents of the Rothschilds bought up these American securities for 1 cent on the dollar, and you created the first big fortunes in the United States. Our first millionaires were all created by the Panic of 1837, and they more or less became the agents of the Bank of England in the United States because their fortunes were entirely due to the outside influence. And of course, the American people had no idea what was going on. They just knew we suddenly had a new class of millionaires, and the fact that they were all foreign agents never dawned on anybody. And so it's gone that way ever since. I have been meaning to write a monetary history of the United States showing that everything that happened in the States and everything that happens here in Canada is engineered by the bankers because their program comes first. The people come last. The only thing that people have to worry about is how to pay the interest on these enormous debts which the bankers create out of nothing. That's your problem. You've got to come up with that interest. Before you buy food or anything else, you've got to pay that interest. Because, you see, it's a moral obligation. You should pay your debts, you know. And they always come. It's amazing. The bankers are totally corrupt and totally without scruples. But they always bring in the fact that you have a moral obligation to pay your debts. And so people believe that. They say, oh, yes, I don't want my credit impugned, and I want to be a good citizen, so I'm going to see to it that we pay these debts, even if we don't have any food on the table. But they usually manage to give you a little food, too. We get back to the subsistence wage. They don't want you to starve to death. They don't want you to get fat, but they certainly want you to survive from day to day, and that's what they do. And, of course, this has a devastating effect on the morals of the country. I have claimed for years that the Federal Reserve System and the central bank, which you have here, has a very depressing moral effect on the entire population. Because instead of people being constructive and building their lives and having constructive careers, their first obligation is to pay all this interest to the bankers. After that, you can start having some moral scruples. But until you pay that interest, you cannot do anything. And that comes first. So they've trained people to do this, that they must pay their debts. Even though the people don't owe these debts, the people didn't incur these debts, and the people don't even owe the interest, because it's all created out of nothing. And that is Kabbalistic, because creating things out of nothing is God's purpose on earth. But it's not up to mere humans to create things out of nothing. So when they create money out of nothing, they're superseding the will of God. They're indulging in Kabbalah, which is black magic. And that's why you have cultism and you have drugs and all these things. It all stems from the Kabbalistic origin of money creation. And so that's what you have to deal with. You're dealing with black magic. And all of the banking system, believe it or not, is black magic. It's not based on what people earn or what they produce. It's based on the Kabbalistic idea of creating something from nothing through incantations, through rituals, through cults. And it's anti-God. It's anti all religious principles. So the people are in this dilemma. They don't understand this. They don't understand that their monetary system is black magic. And so obviously, they have no idea what to do about it. Now, in the States, they tell you to write to your congressman. But unfortunately, as I've told people for years, when you write to your congressman, be sure and enclose a $10,000 check. Because if you don't, your letter goes into the wastebasket. Now, if you enclose a $10,000 check, let's say, well, this guy obviously knows what's going on, so we have to pay a little attention to his views. But without the money, they have a saying in Washington, nothing for nothing. And what that means is, if you don't send something, you don't get anything. In other words, it's an investment. The whole democracy is based on individual investment. If you want to invest something in a congressman, then he'll do something for you. I found that out when I tried to get Ezra Pound released from St. Elizabeth's. Well, we went to a couple of senators and congressmen, and they said, oh, you've got a good case. They'll drop the charges against Ezra Pound. And the lowest price, now this was back about 1950, the lowest price we could get was $5,000 before anybody would do anything. Well, everybody that Ezra knew put together didn't have $5,000, you know. And I was living on $50 a month myself, and most of the people I knew were in the same category. So, of course, nothing was done about getting Ezra out at that time. And we didn't know at that time that in Washington, the name of everything is access. If you have access to a congressman or to some public official, then you can get something done. And generally, the only path of access is through money. So if you have no money, the congressman will be very sympathetic, and he say, well, what has been done to Ezra Pound is a terrible injustice, and we've got to do something about it. This will be taken care of, and that's the last you ever hear from them. They don't return your calls after that. And as I say, they're waiting for the money. And the idea that this is a money culture has been imposed on us by the bankers, because actually money should not be very important. In fact, when I worked for H.L. Hunt, the richest man in the world, he was totally bewildered by me, because obviously I had a lot of ability and so forth, and a very successful record, but I had no interest in money. And in fact, H.L. Hunt would sometimes get annoyed because the people didn't understand him. They published a story that he was the richest man in the world, and that he had an income of $1 million a week. So he told me later, he snorted, I said, you know, they said you had $1 million a week. He just, after snorting, he was very indignant. He said, that wouldn't touch it. He said, I actually had $10 million a week at that time. So he was very offended that the press would tell these lies about him, and he only had $1 million a week. And he was really insulted. Yeah, Texas was a money culture, by the way. Even at that time, if you didn't have over $100 million, you were considered a very poor person. You were not a player. And you should have at least $300 or $500 million to be a serious player. And so that's the way they judged you in Texas at that time. They judged you by your category, $100 million, $200 million, a billion, and so forth. And it's probably pretty much that way today. But that has changed somewhat because, here again, the growth of the bureaucracy in Washington and the increasing power of officials, so the amount of money that you have is not really as important as the access that you have to people. I mean, if you can send President Clinton over a nice-looking intern, then you've got more access than the next guy. And just point her out to the Oval Office and send her down the hall, and things take their course. Yeah, Clinton is a sexual psychopath, you know, that no female could pass the Oval Office without his molesting her. I mean, it was he's what they call in psychiatry compulsive obsessive, and he simply cannot let anybody go by without making his move. And we've never had a president like him, and probably never have another one like that again, because politics itself is an all absorbing game. It becomes your whole life, you know. You're out there looking for those millions of votes, and so you haven't got time to chase some girl or even a boy up and down the streets. So you just don't have time to fool with it. But Clinton just happened to be one in a million like that, who did that. And in fact, his wife Hillary, of course, she was disgusted with him years ago. And Hillary's job at the Rose Law Firm was to bring in new clients. And she recruited new clients by being friendly with them. And that was her job. She wasn't much of a lawyer. She hardly ever had a law case. But she did bring in new clients. And one of them was the poor guy who was found dead as a suicide with a gun that nobody had ever seen, which didn't even work. So that also is the way things are done in Washington. It's called the Washington suicide. They also have the Washington heart attack. A person who really becomes a threat will have what they call a Washington heart attack. That was true of Chief Justice Vinson of the Supreme Court. He was all set to rule against the integration decision in the Supreme Court. I think it was 5-2. And he had a Washington heart attack, and they brought in this guy from California, who had murdered his father, and so he ruled that the integration could proceed, and it changed forever the education system in the United States, which is now a total jungle. And if you like jungle life, well, you want to teach school in the United States, because it's different every day. You know, you learn to dodge bullets and knives and the whole work. You don't have much time for teaching, but like I say, every day is very interesting. It's like going to the movies. So we don't want to get too far away from the Federal Reserve System, because what I really want to tell you about today is these consortium of central banks are set up to rob the population of the entire world. We hear about the third world and the developing countries and so forth, and they're being robbed just the way people in Canada and the United States are. It's the same system. It works for everybody. And that's why you send the troops around to different countries to institute some vague purpose, some political purpose, which no one really understands and no one really cares about. But what is going on is the grand Nazi scheme. There's only one political party in the world today, and that's called the Nazis. And you say, well, Adolf Hitler died in 1945, and that was the end of the Nazi party. But that's because you've never been told what the origin of Nazi is. NA is National Socialism, which was the German Nazis. And in 1923, there was a double agent who came to Hitler. And He said to Hitler, look, your Nazi party is not, your National Socialist Party is not getting off the ground. You need an alliance. And he suggested that they ally with the Zionist Party. So the NA of National Socialism joined with the Zionist Party in the World Zionist Party in 1923, and ever after was known as the Nazis, N-A-Z-I. The Z-I was for Zionists, but of course no one knew that, because our popular mythology is that the terrible Nazis were attacking the Jews. But what we were never told is there was a great schism in the Jewish community of the world between the Zionists and the non-Zionists. You see, the non-Zionists were the Orthodox Jews who believed you could not have a Jewish state until the Jewish Messiah came. They didn't acknowledge Christ as Messiah, so they were waiting for their own Jewish Messiah to come. Then you would have a Jewish state, and that Jewish state would rule the world. But the Rothschilds in 1828 decided they couldn't wait for the Jewish Messiah, so they started what they called Reform Judaism under Moses Hess. And Reform Judaism said, yes, you can have a Jewish state before the Messiah comes. And the reason you could have it was the Rothschilds had made so much money, they said, we'll buy our own state. So the Rothschilds sent people out to the Middle East to have Jewish settlements, and which is today the state of Israel, totally created by the Rothschild money. And so Reform Judaism then became the cause of a great schism between Orthodox Jews and Reform Jews. Now, no one has ever told you this, I'm sure, but you think that the Jewish community is monolithic. In fact, it's split sharply down the middle. But even today, they have riots in the Jewish parliament between the Orthodox Jews and the Reform Jews. And they cannot agree on anything because the basic premise is a fundamental disagreement over whether a Jewish state should even exist today. So in Germany in 1923, the German Jews were quite prosperous and quite happy, and they were not interested in becoming Zionists, and they were not interested in going to Palestine. After all, they had beautiful mansions in Germany. They had symphony orchestras, they had art, they had everything, and they were accepted in the community. As Ezra Pound said, Germany was the least anti-Jewish country in Europe. When you went over into Poland and Russia, you had a very strong feeling against Jews. But in Germany, they were accepted and happy, so why would you ever have an anti-Jewish government in Germany? And, of course, Hitler, allying himself with the Zionists, he said, after all, you're right. He said, we have the same goals. And so he allied with the Zionist party, and the mission of the Nazis was to force the anti-Zionist Jews to accept Zionism. And this is what the concentration camps were about. They put the anti-Zionist Jews in the concentration camps, and they were placed under the direct administration of the Sonderkommandos, who were the Zionist Jews. So the concentration camps were run by the Zionist Jews in order to punish and get rid of the anti-Zionist Jews, which they did. And, of course, that's a part of the Holocaust that you were never told, that this was a fundamental Jewish disagreement, which the German people, that Daniel Goldhagen wrote a book in which he said all Germans cooperated in their anti-Jewish feeling and the Holocaust, which was not true at all. The Germans did not even know what was going on, most of them. It's just like in the United States, when we were perfecting the atomic bomb and bombed Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the American people knew nothing about it. It was forbidden to mention the atomic bomb. I was serving in the Air Force at that time. We never heard of any atomic mission or atomic bomb until the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. So you could say the American people are guilty of the greatest atrocity, the dropping of the atomic bomb on Japanese civilians. But that isn't true. The American people knew nothing about it. I knew nothing about it in the Air Force. And I was right there. So these things go on without the knowledge of the people or the approval of the people. But, of course, they have to accept the results. These things happen, and you're stuck with it. So this is the real story of Zionism, that the Nazis. So then, well, if the Nazis